bringing her legs and feet smoothly through the open window after her, and rolled forward in a slow somersault, coming to her feet in the same movement. She stood, waiting for her eyes to become accustomed to the darkness, poised and ready with her hand on the hilt of the axe at her side. The room was empty. 37. Will finished his planned set of songs with a ringing chord on the mandola. He bowed deeply from the waist as the room burst into loud applause, and the knights and their ladies, seated at the lower tables, began to shower coins toward him. As has been noted, he was a good performer, a skilled musician, and a singer with a pleasant voice and a good range. Moreover, he had learned many years ago from Berrigan how to structure a set of songs for an audience. "Don't give away your best songs too early," the older jongler had told him. "You have to build an audience's interest, so your early songs must be good, rousing and entertaining, but not your best. They follow when the audience is captured and ready to participate." Added to the fact that he was a good performer, the audience here in Chateau de Falaise was somewhat starved for entertainment. The chateau was not on any of the main highways through the country. It was something of a backwater, and travelling entertainers were rare here. Baron Lassigny's reputation was another factor that kept travellers away. He was known to have an unpredictable temper and a sadistic mind if someone got on the wrong side of him. That was enough to deter the majority of travelling entertainers from making the trip to this relatively out-of-the-way spot. "More fool them," Will thought, as he bent and scooped the coins into his hat. There was a sizable weight of money in there when he finished, and he noted that few of the coins were copper. Most were silver, with a smattering of gold coins as well. There was something to be said for travelling to a chateau where entertainers were few and far between. He bowed deeply to the room again, then transferred the contents of his hat to the purse hanging from his belt. "Jongleur." The word cut across the low hubbub of conversation in the vast room. Will turned to meet Lassigny's hawk-like gaze. Once more, he bowed from the waist. The Baron was seated at the top table, set crosswise to the long room on a raised dais. His seneschal sat on his left side, and his wife on his right. The Baroness Lassigny was a tall, slim woman, with long, raven-black hair hanging down almost to her waist. She was quite beautiful, Will thought, but that was no surprise. A man with Lassigny's reputation would make sure his consort looked the part. Beautiful as she was, she had a disdainful attitude, looking down on Will, literally and figuratively, and the others in the dining hall, with a supercilious twist to her mouth. It was all too obvious that she considered herself to be superior to them all. Two knights and the Baroness's lady-in-waiting made up the rest of the table. "My lord," Will said, in response to the one-word summons. Lassigny raised a hand and beckoned to him. "You may approach," he said. There was no warmth or welcome in the voice, no sense of praise for a job well done. Will set his mandola down on the nearest table and stepped forward to the base of the dais, looking up into those impenetrable eyes. He stood, waiting. There was nothing for him to say, and Lassigny looked him up and down, assessing, evaluating. Eventually, the Baron spoke again. "Where is your daughter tonight?" he asked. Will wasn't expecting the question, but he showed no sign of surprise or uncertainty. "You don't miss much," he thought. "She has a slight chill, my lord," he said. "She took to her bed early." It was unlikely that the Baron would check the veracity of this reply, Will thought. He had more important matters to consider than the health of a young girl travelling with a lowly jongler. In any event, Will and Maddie had placed a pair of pillows under her blanket and pulled the curtain shut across her sleeping niche. Any casual inspection would see a huddled figure beneath the blankets. If there was a more than casual inspection, questions might be asked. But if such were the case, Will's and Maddie's movements would have already aroused suspicion. Perhaps, Will thought suddenly, Lassini had heard about the young girl caught wandering in the upper floors of the keep. Lassini's next statement seemed to discount this concern. "So she missed your performance," he said. It was difficult to tell if this was intended as a statement or a question. Will shrugged and assumed a self-effacing grin. "She has heard me sing before, my lord," he said. Lassini didn't return the smile. He simply nodded. "Of course. How long have you been in this country?" he asked suddenly. Will was beginning to see a technique in his questioning. Ask a series of questions, and then suddenly switch tack to a new, unrelated topic. "A few weeks, my lord. Nearly a month," he replied. Lassini considered the answer for several seconds. "Yet you have several Gallican songs in your repertoire," he commented. Will nodded. "A good jongler always prepares for a new audience, my lord. I've encountered several Gallican jonglers travelling through Araluen. It's a close community, and we tend to learn songs from one another." "Although we don't teach each other our best songs," Will thought with a wry smile. "Those ones we have to steal while our foreign colleagues aren't watching." "A pity about your execrable accent, of course. It rather ruins the effect." The hall was silent. The people at the tables had enjoyed Will's rendering of the Gallic folk songs he had included in his bracket. None of them had objected to his accent, although nobody was about to disagree with Lassini's opinion. Once again, Will bowed his head in apology. "I do my best, my lord," he said humbly. Lassini sniffed derisively. "If you plan to perform in my country, you should do us all the courtesy of pronouncing our language accurately," he said coldly. There was no answer Will could think of that might not be seen as argumentative. He remained silent, meeting Lassini's black, impenetrable stare. Eventually, the Baron gave a small, derogatory snort and broke eye contact with Will, turning to look at the Seneschal. "Still," he said, "your performance was reasonable in spite of that shortcoming. Pay him, Gaston." The Seneschal produced a small leather sack and tossed it down to the lower level. Will caught it and glanced briefly at it while he weighed it in his hands. It wasn't very heavy. If the contents were gold, it wasn't an overly generous payment for his work. But then he thought, generous was not a word one would associate with Baron Lassini. He slipped the small sack inside his jerkin and touched his forehead with his right forefinger in salute. "Your lordship is too kind," he said, making sure there was no trace of the sarcasm he felt in his voice. Lassini stared at him, still unblinking. Will found himself wondering if he had actually seen the Gallic Baron blink at any time. He couldn't remember doing so.
"Yes, I am."
Lassini turned to his wife, who had watched the conversation with a sneer twisting her full lips.
"What do you say, my dear? Shall we have the jongleur perform for us again?"
She shrugged.
"Why not? His singing is tolerable, and Lord knows there's little else to listen to of an evening."
That's a ringing endorsement if ever I heard one, Will thought.
"That's settled, then," Lassini said. "You'll sing for us again on the 6th day."
Will shifted his feet uncomfortably.
"I had planned to leave on the 6th day morning, my lord," he said. There was no harm in letting the Baron know that he wasn't planning on staying around indefinitely. Lassany's expression didn't alter. "You will perform for us here on the 6th day, he repeated, his tone unvarying. "Am I making myself clear?" "Abundantly, my lord," Will replied, and bowed once more. "And next time, make sure your daughter is with you," Lassany told him. 38. Maddie crossed to the door and placed her ear against it, holding her breath as she listened. There was no sound of anyone moving outside in the corridor. No sound of voices. She rested her hand on the door handle and slowly eased it down. There was a large key in the door, but, as there was nobody in the room, she assumed that the door wouldn't be locked. She was right. As the door latch slid back, thankfully making very little sound, she let the door open a crack and listened again. Again, nothing. That wasn't to say there weren't a dozen armed men in the corridor outside, waiting for her to emerge. She placed her eye against the narrow gap and tried to see out. Her view was restricted, but so far as she could see, there was nobody in sight. "Here goes," she muttered, and eased the door fully open, moving as smoothly as she could, without rushing and making undue noise. She stepped out into the corridor, her hand on the hilt of her sax, and quickly looked to either side. The dimly lit space, illuminated by a row of oil lamps set on the wall, was empty. The staircase was in the centre of the tower, with rooms running round the outside wall. Quickly, she moved to the stairs and glanced upward. These stairs didn't spiral like the ones in the keep. They were constructed in a series of switchbacks, with two flights leading from one floor to another, reversing direction halfway up. The stairwell itself was square in shape, and as she peered upward, it disappeared in darkness. Looking down, she could see faint traces of light below her. There was no sound. She estimated she was on the 6th floor of the tower, high enough not to hear the murmur of voices on the 3rd floor, which was at the height of the walkway around the curtain wall. She stepped carefully onto the stairway, aware that such stairs were often constructed so they moved when someone put their weight on them, the resultant noise alerting people above that someone was coming. Accordingly, she kept to the side of the stairs, where any such movement would be minimal. There was a faint squeak, and she moved up another step, then progressed slowly, testing each step as she placed her foot on it. At the 5th step, she felt excessive movement and an incipient squeak of loose timbers rubbing together. She took her foot off the step and placed it on the next highest. There was no noise this time, so she continued upward, testing each step as she went. She reached the landing that marked the switchback. It was likely that there would be more loose boards here, and she trod carefully, locating one and stepping over it. Then she was on the 2nd flight of the switchback, leading to the 7th floor. She reached the top with a minimum of noise and crouched on hands and knees, listening. This floor seemed to be more brightly lit than the lower floors, she noticed. A sudden burst of laughter startled her, setting her heart racing. 2 or 3 men, she estimated, farther along the corridor, and suddenly laughing at a joke. The laughter died away, and now she could make out the sound of voices talking. But they were muffled, and she couldn't make out the words. Crouching low, she peered round the edge of the stairway, keeping her face as close to the floor as possible. 5 meters away, she saw four armed soldiers outside one of the doors. As she had noted, there was more light on this floor. In addition to the oil lamps, there were two large candelabra set on a table. Four canvas and wood chairs were ranged in a semicircle facing the door. There were a flagon and four goblets on the table. As she watched, one of the men took the flagon and filled the goblets. His companions took one each, and they all drank deeply. One of them said something, and there was another burst of laughter. Seizing the opportunity, and realizing that the men's attention would be distracted momentarily, she slipped around the banister pole to the next flight of steps, and went up again. By now, she was accustomed to feeling her way and testing each step before she placed her full weight on it, and she moved more quickly. She reached the landing and the switchback and continued upward. As she did, the voices faded to a murmur once more, as the stairway blocked the sound. Four steps from the top, she slowed down. The light was dim above her, and there was no sound of voices, other than the faint murmur from below, punctuated occasionally by bursts of laughter. The eighth floor, the top floor of the tower, was a different arrangement from the lower floors. Instead of rooms set around the outer curve of the tower, it was an open space. There were no lamps here, and the only light came from the moon striking through the windows. She rose to her feet, moving into the space, and studied the room. On one side was a large rack of crossbows and quivers, each full of quarrels. A ladder led to a trapdoor in the ceiling. She climbed quickly to the top, pushing the trapdoor open and peering out. The trapdoor gave access to a flat roof, surrounded by a crenellated wall, forming a fighting position from which crossbowmen could shoot down on enemies attacking the castle and trying to scale the curtain wall. Against the outer wall there was a lifting beam, with several large cauldrons set beside it. "Boiling oil or water," she muttered, glancing around and seeing a fireplace in the centre of the space, where such liquids could be heated, then transferred to the lifting beam, hoisted up and poured on those below. She lowered the trapdoor and climbed back down the ladder, studying the eighth floor once more. In addition to the rack of crossbows, there were spears in racks, a dozen bunks, and several tables with benches. Obviously, in times of danger, soldiers would be stationed here to defend the castle. It was similar to the higher floors of the towers at Castle Araluen. Orienting herself, she moved to one of the windows set round the wall, judging that it would correspond to the room below, outside which the guards were stationed. She leaned out and peered down. There was a window some 4 meters below her, and she could see a gleam of light coming from it. "That must be where they're holding Gilles," she muttered to herself, and uncoiled the length of rope that was around her shoulders. She looked around for a point to anchor the rope, and selected one of the bunks. She tested it, pushing against it, to make sure it wouldn't slide across the floor when she committed her weight to it. She didn't want any noise to alert the guards who were directly below. But the bunk was solidly built from heavy timbers, and she couldn't budge it. Quickly, she knotted the end of the rope round the leg of the bunk and went to the window. "He's on the seventh floor, in an outside chamber," Maddie said. Will glanced casually at the tower, scanning upward to the second last floor. "You're sure it's him?" he asked. Maddie shrugged. "As sure as I can be. I climbed to the eighth floor and let myself down on a rope to look in the window. He's a young man, a little below average height and wearing expensive clothes. Who else could it be?" "Does he look like the portrait the king showed us?" Will asked. Maddie hesitated. "Who does look like their portrait?" she said finally. "It could be him, but I suspect the portrait painter erred on the side of flattery when he did that painting. For a start, he gave him a chin, but there is a strong resemblance to the king himself. It was the morning after Maddie's exploration of the tower. They were strolling in the garden area once more, the best place to keep their conversation private. Aside from a few words when Maddie returned to the common room the night before, it was the first time they had had to compare notes. "What's on the top floor?" Will asked. "It's open space. I'd say it's intended to be part of the castle's defences in case of an attack. There's access to the flat roof above it, and there are racks of crossbows and weapons and bunks for troops." "And you didn't make contact with him last night?" Maddie shook her head. "I didn't. I figured there'd be a risk we might be overheard by the guards outside, and I knew we'd have to contact him again to get him out. I thought this way I'd halve the risk." Will considered this for a few seconds. "Good thinking," he said. "How will we get him out?" Maddie asked. Will rubbed his chin with thumb and forefinger. "I guess we can get him out of the tower easily enough. We'll take him back up to the top floor, then down the stairs and out through the window on the sixth. We can lower him on a rope if he's not up to climbing." Maddie rolled her eyes. "He's a Gallic prince. I doubt he's up to climbing or much else. Getting him out of the castle is another matter. The only way out is the main gate and the causeway. We'll hide him in the stables until the sixth hour, when the gate opens each day. The kitchens don't start serving breakfast until the eighth hour, and we've seen that he's fed after everyone else's meals are served. Odds are, nobody will discover he's missing until his meal is delivered. So, we'll ride out, saying we're exercising the horses. We can steal a horse for him, and he can come a few metres behind us." Will nodded toward the main gate. "I've been watching the guards at the gate over the past few days, and, while they check on people coming in, they don't take too much notice of people leaving the castle. I guess they think if you're in here, you've already been checked. But if the worst comes to the worst, and we can't bluff our way out, we may have to fight. There are six guards at the gate. But if we take them by surprise, we should make it out. While we've distracted the guards, he can ride out. Then we ride as if the devil is after us." Maddie pursed her lips. "That's one too many ifs for my liking," she said. Will shrugged. "Can you think of another way?" She shook her head. "Neither can I. And at least this plan is simple, which is all to the good." "I suppose so," Maddie agreed. "One thing," Will said. "We're going to have to do it in the next 2 days. I think Lassini is getting suspicious about us. He was asking where you were last night, and he's engaged me to sing again on the sixth day. And I don't think he liked my singing all that much." "Suspicious? What does he suspect?" Maddie asked. Will shook his head. "We're strangers. We're foreigners. And he's a man who's up to his neck in plots and treachery. Men like that are always suspicious." "Then the sooner we get the prince out, the better," Maddie said. "Let's do it tonight." Will thought about it for several seconds, then nodded slowly. "That's what I was thinking," he said. 39. They planned the rescue mission for the third hour after midnight. The moon was due to set at the first hour, and there was a heavy cloud cover, so they would have ample darkness and shadow to conceal their movements. This would be important if three of them were to make it down the outside of the tower and across to the stairs leading up to the ramparts without being seen by the sentries. It had been relatively easy for Maddie to manage this, But with three of them, the chances of being noticed were much higher, particularly as the prince was unused to moving without being seen. The day passed slowly. They visited the stables in the early afternoon, on the pretext of feeding and watering their horses and cleaning out their stall. They took their few belongings with them, and concealed them in the back of the stall. Maddie forked extra straw into the stall, piling it at the rear. They would use it to conceal Prince Gilles when he was in the stable. Will checked the leather bow case. It appeared to have been untouched since they had left it at the back of the stall. Both bows and quivers were still inside, as well as two double scabbards, each one with a saxe and a throwing knife. The one item Will didn't take with him was his mandola. It hung on a peg outside his sleeping space in the keep, and it would be too obvious if he were to remove it to the stables, a clue that he was planning to leave. "Pity," he said, regarding it as they returned to the common room. "I'll miss that mandola." Maddie smiled sympathetically. "Just as well it's not your gilet," she said. The gilet was Will's pride and joy, a mandola made by one of Araluen's finest luthiers, which had been given to him many years prior. It was a very expensive instrument, and he had decided not to risk it to the rigours of travel. The evening meal was served at the usual time. It was a rich vegetable stew, with fresh, crusty bread from the kitchen and jugs of ale, wine and water on the table. Maddie's stomach was churning with anticipation of the coming action, and she picked at her food until Will admonished her. "Eat up," he said. "You won't be getting breakfast, and you don't know when your next meal is going to be." She nodded, realizing the good sense of his statement, and applied herself to the task of finishing the bowl. The food served in the common hall was simple, and the menu unvarying, but it was tasty and nourishing all the same. Although, this time, she might as well have been eating straw for all the flavour she found in her food. They finished the meal with coffee, sweetened with honey as usual. Will had prevailed on one of the servers to provide a small bowl for them at each meal. As the platters and bowls were cleared away, the people in the common hall broke up into small groups, pulling their stools into circles, and talking and laughing together while they finished the ale and the wine. Will pushed back his stool from the table and rose. "Let's get some sleep," he said. "It's going to be a long night." Maddie yawned as he said it. She had been awake most of the previous night, and had had no chance to catch up on her sleep during the day. But, as they headed toward the sleeping niches set around the wall, a servant intercepted them. "How about the few songs, Jongleur?" he asked. His tone was friendly, and he gestured toward a small group of his fellow workers, who were gathered in a half-circle, watching hopefully. Will hid his reluctance behind a smile. After all, no jongleur would refuse such a request, as it would provide an opportunity to earn a little extra money. As he took the mandola down from its peg, he was glad he had decided not to take it to the stables with their other belongings. Its absence might have been difficult to explain. He moved to the small semicircle of expectant staff, hooking a stool with his foot as he went, and positioning it in front of them. A few other people in the room, seeing he was preparing to sing, moved to join the audience. Maddie, deciding that her absence might be noticed, took a seat at the rear of the audience, where she could lean back against one of the long tables. "It's all right for you," she thought to herself, as Will launched into his opening song. "This gives you something to take your mind off things, while I'm sitting here thinking about all that can go wrong." The tight knot of tension was back in her stomach. Waiting was always the hardest part, she thought. In spite of the tension, or perhaps because of it, she yawned hugely. She closed her eyes, hoping that the sweet sound of the mandola and Will's soothing voice might help her relax. After several minutes, she sensed movement in the people around her and opened her eyes, looking around the room. The seneschal, Sir Gaston, had entered the room and was scrutinizing the occupants with his gaze. Seeing Will performing to a small but attentive audience, he watched for several minutes, his foot tapping in time to the music. Will looked up, caught his eye, and acknowledged him with a slight bow of the head. Sir Gaston nodded in return, then turned away and headed for the large doorway. Odds are, he was on his way to the dining hall on the next floor, where he would report to the Baron. "Just as well that servant asked you to sing," Maddie thought. "Sir Gaston will report that all is normal in the common room." Will sang another two songs after the seneschal had left, then brought the performance to a close. The audience clapped appreciatively, and, one by one, they rose to drop a coin or two into his hat, which was laid on a bench beside him. Then they drifted away, breaking up into smaller groups. Will scooped the money into his belt purse, then hung the mandola on its peg once more. Maddie noticed his hand lingered on its polished wood surface for a few seconds as he stroked the instrument in a private gesture of farewell. Then he caught her eye and nodded meaningfully at her sleeping niche. She rose and moved to the narrow bed, removing her boots and swinging her legs up onto the mattress before pulling her blanket up around her. Will peered round the end of her curtain. "I'll wake you at 3, he said. She nodded. She knew he had an uncanny knack of waking himself at any hour he pleased. He pulled the curtain shut, cutting out the dim light from the common room. Maddie lay on her back, breathing deeply, listening to the muted conversations around the room. She noted the strange phenomenon that, when a person is half asleep but conscious, they can hear the voices around them more clearly, and listen in on conversations that are being carried on in lowered tones some distance away. She yawned again, but sleep eluded her, even as the room outside her niche grew quieter and darker, and people drifted off to bed, dousing their lanterns as they went. Her mind raced, going over their plan, listing the things that could go wrong. The curtain wall sentry might see her, or Will, as they climbed the tower. What if Prince Gilles cried out in alarm when they entered his tower room, alerting the guards outside his door? What if he lost his nerve and made a noise or fell when they hauled him up to the top floor? What if they were spotted as they descended from the 6th floor to the battlements? What if the stable master woke when they entered the stables to wait for the morning? What if? What if? What if? She had told Will there were too many ifs involved in this rescue attempt. Now all of them crowded into her mind, dispelling any possibility of sleep, leaving her tossing and turning on the thin, straw-filled mattress. The watchtower bell struck 12. She counted the strokes, but her mind was racing and she couldn't sleep. Still wide awake, she heard it strike 1, then 2. Then, perversely, in the last hour, she drifted off, waking suddenly when Will's hand shook her shoulder gently. As she did, she heard the bell finish striking 3. "Time to go," Will whispered. 40. The main door to the keep was supported by rusty hinges that creaked loudly when the door was opened or shut. By day, this wasn't too big a problem, as the sound blended into the ambient noise of the comings and goings in the courtyard outside. But now, in the still of the early morning, all was silent outside, and the squeaking hinges would be audible around the courtyard and on the battlements. Will had brought a small bottle of thin oil with him, and they paused inside the door as he pored liberal amounts over the three large hinges. Maddie fidgeted impatiently as they waited for the oil to penetrate the crevices in the hinges and lubricate the metal. Will frowned at her and mouthed the words, "Be still." She sighed quietly and tried to settle down. Finally, after what seemed like an age, Will nodded to her and took hold of the large metal ring that opened the door latch. He turned it and eased the door open several centimetres, testing the effect of the oil. There was an initial squeak as the door first moved. Then the hinges fell silent as the oil smoothed their movement. Will opened the door a few more centimetres. There was no further noise, and he opened the door wide enough to let Maddie pass through. "Go," he said softly. She slipped through the narrow gap and, hugging the wall, turned left, away from the tower. They had planned this earlier. If they were seen crossing the courtyard, it was better that they weren't seen heading for the tower where Gilles was kept prisoner. Will had decided that they should make for the stables first, then, keeping close to the base of the curtain wall, move around to the stairs leading up beside the southwest tower, staying in the deep shadows under the walkway. He watched as Maddie's dark form crossed to the stables, then disappeared in the shadow. Then he slipped round the door, closing it gently behind him, and followed her. The courtyard on this side wasn't completely empty, another reason for choosing this route. There were stone benches, a drinking trough for horses, and several mounting blocks on the way, each of them providing cover to conceal their furtive progress from any eyes that might happen to look their way. Will slipped from one piece of cover, from one area of shadow, to the next. He moved swiftly, but without undue haste that might attract attention or catch a sentry's peripheral vision. He passed the stables, sheltering for a few seconds in the deep shadow under its recessed main door. He waited, watching and listening, to see if there was any sign that their movement had been noticed. There was no outcry, no sound of alarm, so he continued, slipping across the last piece of open ground to the line of shadow under the walkway. As he ghosted his way into the concealing darkness, Maddie rose from a crouch in front of him. He nodded to her and jerked his head toward the stairway beside the southwest tower. They could hear the measured tread of the battlement sentries on the wooden walkway above their heads as they made their way with virtually no sound around the inner wall to the stairway. Maddie crouched at the base, waiting for him, and he signalled her to go ahead. On hands and knees, she swarmed up the stairs, staying close to the wall. He watched from below, seeing her freeze as the sentry's footsteps approached. Then, as he turned away again, she continued to the top of the stairs, stopping just below the walkway level. Silently, Will followed her, reaching a spot just below her as the sentry returned. They had planned the next sequence of movements earlier in the day. As the sentry began his return patrol, Maddie slid over the top of the stairs and moved to the battlements alongside the tower. Will waited. There was no time for two of them to make it to the battlements at the same time, and not enough cover for two of them to stay concealed if they did. He peered carefully over the top of the stairs. The sentry was halfway along his prescribed beat. His opposite number was still far enough away not to notice Maddie's dark form as she climbed onto the battlements, crouching low, then clambered onto the wall of the tower, moving out around the curve so that she was out of sight. Will waited, crouching in the darkness, as the sentry returned. He was confident in his ability to remain unseen. After all, he'd been doing this sort of thing for over 20 years now. But still, His heart beat at an accelerated rate inside his chest. There was always the chance that something could go wrong. He counted slowly to himself, hearing the sentry come back, then turn away. He had to give Maddie time to climb to the higher level and lower a rope for him. He reached 200 as the man was on his return path. He'd have to wait now until he reached the tower, turned again and headed back. He heard the footsteps grow louder. They stopped just above him, and he heard the sentry yawn. Then his boots scraped on the walkway as he turned and headed off once more. Will rose to a crouch and swarmed across the walkway to the wall. In the chamber on the sixth floor, Maddie waited impatiently. She knew Will would have to time his movements to coincide with the sentry, but he seemed to be taking an interminable time about it, she thought. She had gained entry to the same room with no problem. The window was still unlatched from where she had opened it the night before. Obviously, the chamber was unoccupied. Tonight, she had brought with her a bent piece of wire, which would let her hook the latch behind them when they made their way back down. That way, there would be no evidence of the route taken by the escaping prince. She peered out the window, looking down, waiting for Will to appear. There was no fear that she might be seen. She was halfway around the curve of the tower wall, concealed from the sentry's view. Then she saw the dark shape moving on the wall below her, scrabbling his way out and around the curve of the tower to a point where he, too, was concealed from the battlements. She gave a soft whistle and saw the pale oval of his face as he looked up, spread-eagled on the wall. She lowered the rope that she had ready until it reached him, then secured it to the leg of the bed in the room with a series of half-hitches. Taking hold of the rope, Will leaned back, placed his feet against the rough surface of the wall, and began to climb. "It's all right for you to go climbing up the wall like a giant spider," he had told her earlier. "But I'm older and heavier than you. I'll use a rope, thank you very much." In spite of his protestations, he climbed quickly, and when he slid over the windowsill to join her, he was barely breathing hard. "He's very fit," she thought, and led the way to the door. There was no need for them to speak. They had planned their movements meticulously during the day. As before, she eased the door open and checked the central space outside. There was no sign or sound of movement, so the two of them, moving like silent shadows, made their way across to the stairway and started up. This was familiar ground to her now, and she had briefed Will thoroughly. As they went higher, they began to hear the mutter of voices drifting down the stairway from the seventh floor. The guards weren't as noisy as the previous night, but then it was much later, and probably some of them were dozing while the others kept watch. She signalled upward with her thumb, and the two of them slid round the banister pole and started up to the top floor. They wasted no time looking round the big open space, but headed directly to the window she had used the night before. Will unlocked it while she fastened the rope to a bed once more. They stood together, peering down at the window directly below them. She seized hold of the rope and started to climb onto the windowsill, but Will stopped her with a hand on her shoulder. "I'll go first," he said softly. "When you see me go through the window, you follow me." She nodded and stood aside as he climbed onto the windowsill and let his legs dangle over the long drop. He took hold of the rope and, in a smooth movement, swung out, placing his feet against the wall and walking himself down the tower to the window below. She craned out, watching him as he settled on the window ledge. The clouds cleared for a few moments. She saw the gleam of starlight on his sacks and heard a faint click as he unlatched the window. Then he went through the open window and disappeared from view. she took the rope in both hands and lowered herself over the edge, going hand over hand down the rope. One floor down, Will stood by the window, getting his bearings. The room was lit by the dim glow of a small lamp set on a table in the centre of the room. Either Gilles was a nervous sleeper, or, more likely, the lamp was kept burning so the sentries could check on him from time to time. There would almost certainly be a spy hole in the door somewhere. Gilles himself was flat on his back in a narrow bed set against the wall. The soft sound of his snoring indicated that he was fast asleep. A faint, slithering sound from the window told Will that Maddie had followed him down. She swung her legs through the open window, then eased herself down into the room. He put a finger to his lips, an unnecessary warning he realized, and pointed to where Gilles was sleeping. He then pointed to himself, indicating that he would wake the prince. Maddie looked at the door. Outside, the guards seemed to have fallen silent. Or maybe the thickness of the door masked the sound of their soft conversation. She took a pace toward the door, her hand on the hilt of her sax, and nodded to Will, indicating that she was ready. Will took a deep breath. This was going to be the tricky part, he thought, waking Prince Gilles without having him make too much noise. He crossed silently to the bed and knelt beside it. He readied his hand above the prince's open mouth. Just as well he's sleeping on his back, he thought. Things would have been much more difficult if he had been on his side, facing the wall. He placed his mouth close to Gilles' ear and dropped his hand over his mouth, holding him firmly, muffling any sound the prince might make, preventing him from crying out. He felt the young man's body stiffen in alarm as he came awake and heard a faint grunt as he tried to speak. "Don't cry out, Prince Gilles," Will whispered in the prince's ear. "We're here to rescue you. Your father sent us. Relax. We're friends." He could see the prince's eyes, wide and ringed with white, staring up at him. Gradually, as his words sank in, he felt the young man relax. "Do you understand?" Will continued, keeping his voice low and calm. "We're friends. Don't make a sound." Gilles nodded his head, insofar as he was able to nod under that iron grip. Will saw the alarmed look in his eyes drain away, and the prince lay still. "I'm going to take my hand away," he continued, maintaining a soothing, even tone of voice. "Don't make a sound, all right?" Again the prince nodded, and Will slowly removed his hand, ready at a moment's notice to replace it. But Gilles was silent, apart from his ragged, panicky breathing. Will nodded encouragement. Keeping his face close to Gilles' ear, he continued to speak in the same quiet, soothing tone. "That's good," he said. "Now, here's what we're going to do." 41. He eased his hand under Gilles' shoulders, raising him to a sitting position and turning him so his feet were on the floor. "We're going out the window," he said, indicating the open window a few metres away. Instantly, he felt Gilles' body stiffen, and he saw the whites of his eyes widen in fear. "Don't worry," Will whispered, trying to sound as reassuring as possible while keeping his voice lowered. "We'll have you on a rope, and we'll pull you up to the next floor. You won't have to do anything." The young prince shook his head. "But I can't," he began, fear causing his voice to rise to a dangerous level. Quickly, Will clamped his hand over the young man's mouth again and shook his head. "Keep your voice down," he whispered urgently. "The Baron's men are just outside that door." He felt the prince breathing rapidly, but some of the tension went out of his body, and he looked at Will, motioning for the ranger to remove his hand. Carefully, Will did, as Gilles requested, ready in an instant to clamp it back over his mouth if necessary. "But the height," Gilles whispered. "I have no head for heights." Will patted his shoulder. "Just keep your eyes closed and we'll do all the work," he said. "Now, come on." With his arm around the young man's waist, Will raised him to his feet and urged him towards the open window where Maddie stood, her hand stretched out to him. Fearfully, Gilles stepped across the room until he had taken Maddie's hand. She drew him toward her so that he was leaning against the wall to one side of the window. Will turned back to the bed and quickly stripped off the quilt. Rolling it into a cylinder, he lay it on the bed and pulled the blankets up over it. He regarded it critically. To a casual glance, it looked as if there were someone asleep in the bed. "That should do it," he said to himself. Then he joined Maddie and Gilles by the window. "You'll have to go first," Maddie told him. "I can't pull him up by myself." He nodded and reached out the window for the dangling rope. As he did so, Gilles, thinking he was about to be tied on and forced out the window, pulled away from Maddie's grasp. There was a small table against the wall, with an unlit candle in a candlestick on it. The frightened prince bumped against it, and before Maddie could reach it, the pewter candlestick toppled and fell, rolling off the table and onto the floor with a crash that sounded deafening to their highly strained senses. Instantly, Will flung his cloak over Gilles and dragged the prince down to a crouched position beneath the window. Maddie froze against the wall, pulling her own cloak tight around her. There was a rattle from the door as the cover to the peephole was flung open. For a moment, a glimmer of light showed from outside the room, only to be snuffed out as someone put their eye to the peephole. Fortunately, the window wasn't in a direct line with the peephole. It was off to one side. Maddie's heart pounded against her ribs. Then she heard the peephole cover closing and a voice from outside the door. "It's all right. He's still asleep." They waited for several minutes, making sure the guards were satisfied. Then Will swung himself up onto the windowsill, gripped the rope and started climbing. Maddie watched the end of the rope jerking in time to his movements. Then it fell slack, and she knew he'd reached the window above them. A minute or so later, the rope reappeared, jerking up and down several times as he signalled to her. She leaned out the window, caught the loose end, and brought it inside, knotting it quickly around Gilles' body, under his arms. Gilles whimpered, looking fearfully at the window and sensing the long drop below it. "Come on," she said, urging him toward the window. But he shook his head and pulled away, muttering indistinctly. She put her mouth close to his ear and spoke urgently, albeit in a lowered tone. "For pity's sake, get a grip. If you keep making noise, they'll be in here and we'll be captured. Now come on." Again, Gilles shook his head and tried to pull away from the open window. Finally, Maddie's patience gave out. Quickly, she drew her sacks and slammed the hilt against the side of Gilles' head, stunning him. As his knees gave way, she caught him and draped him over the windowsill to prevent him falling to the floor. She tugged fiercely on the rope and felt it tighten as Will began to haul the dazed prince up. She guided his legs and feet out the window and watched as he slowly rose, in a series of small jerks, out of sight. It seemed like an eternity before the rope dropped outside the window once more. She seized it, slipped the loop around her shoulders, then went out the window and climb-walked up the tower wall to the top floor. She went head-first over the sill, rolling to her feet and casting the rope to one side. Will was kneeling beside Gilles, who was shaking his head blearily. "What happened?" he asked her. She shook her head angrily. "He panicked, and I had to knock him out." She let go a huge sigh of relief, feeling the tension of the last few minutes releasing as her heart rate slowed. They were out of Gilles' chamber, away from his guards. Now it was a simple matter of making their way down to the sixth floor and lowering him to the walkway on the wall. "And if he doesn't go quietly," she thought, "I'll knock him senseless again." Will was heaving Gilles to his feet. The Gallican prince shook his head, a puzzled look on his face. "Are you all right?" Will said, and Gilles nodded uncertainly. Will led him to the door, one hand under his elbow. He paused again and laid his ear against the rough wood of the door. There was no sound from outside. "Okay," he said. "It's all clear. Just follow me and stay quiet. If anything..." He got no further. The door crashed open, and the room was flooded with light as Baron Lassily and half a dozen armed men burst in from outside. "Well, well," said the Baron, in a voice thick with sarcasm. "It seems the jongleur has come to sing you to sleep." His eyes shot to Maddie as she made a belated attempt to draw her sacks. "Don't do it," he warned her. Will gestured for her to stop. "Leave it, Maddie," he ordered. Against so many men, armed with swords and clubs, their two saxes would be hopelessly overmatched. As Maddie let the weapon drop back into its sheath, the Baron signalled his men forward. "Tie them up," he ordered. "They're under arrest." To be continued. This is John Keating. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Ranger's Apprentice, The Royal Ranger, Book 4, The Missing Prince, by John Flanagan. This programme was directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Juliana Wilson. Edited by Elgin Productions, Inc. Text copyright 2020 by John Flanagan. Production copyright 2020. Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.